Welcome to this very special edition of the KJ Masterclass Live, the show which ensures that you profit from your time spent here with experts, either through the industry insights, information, or simply learning from them. And today we have Dr. Rebecca Troy. She's an expert in educational neuroscience and specializes in dyslexia treatment. She holds a doctorate in education, is a researcher in neuroscience and reading disabilities. Welcome to the show, Dr. Rebecca.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You are welcome to the show, Dr. Rebecca. You are welcome to India in this online form. And I'm sure not just in India, but a lot of people across the world will benefit by knowing more about dyslexia, about, you know, understanding dyslexia. So my first question is first to understand you, Dr. Rebecca. Tell us a bit about your journey. So that, you know, people know who they are listening to, who they are understanding this thing from.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, thank you again for having me. But I think my journey is a little bit atypical in that I was a classroom teacher. And so I was responsible for English for grades 9 through 12. So 14-year-olds through 18-year-olds. And in the United States, specifically where I live, over 60% of our kids are below basic in reading, meaning that I had a ton of children come to my classroom without the ability to read. And so what was tricky is that in my teacher preparation programs, it was assumed that 14-year-olds could already read, and so could 15 and 16 and 17-year-olds too. And so it was very difficult for me as a classroom teacher to not know how to help them. That was not a part of my training. It wasn't expected that I knew anything about dyslexia, but the likelihood that those children were struggling with reading because of dyslexia is profound. So 1 in 5 people actually is thought to have dyslexia, and it's very, very unknown. So I went back to get additional degrees and certifications to be a reading specialist. And while I was there, I was under the direction of one of the first researchers to do neuroscience and reading disability study, which opened up my aperture, gave me all kinds of interest and passion in the topic. So when I went on to do further study myself, that's what I decided to do and to research. So for the last 20 years, we've been helping clients to reorganize the way that their brain is hearing and responding to language, so that they can read and spell confidently and with ease. So the brain is malleable. You are able to make significant changes in how it's performing and functioning. But I think the big thing is that not a lot of people know about dyslexia at all, let alone how to reorganize the brain. So that's kind of a little bit about me and how we got started.
Wonderful. Wonderful, Dr. Rebecca. Now, I want to understand, as a general person, as a common person, how would they know if someone is having dyslexia? Mm-hmm. Or I meet someone in any public setting. For example, I may be finding it difficult to read something because at that moment I am not in a position to, you know, I'm just shocked or in any other. Or maybe, you know, I have seen so much of social media, I'm not able to, you know, I've lost that. Many people do not have a problem, but many, for example, many a times it can happen that while doing a show like this, I may get so stunned by something of a thought that I may forget my own name.
Right.
That is why many, it happens. Anything can happen. So that does not mean that anyone is having dyslexia. So how do you actually ensure that, yeah, this is not because of any other reason, but actually because of the reasons that dyslexia actually happens? How do one know?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there is a neurobiological difference between a typical person and somebody with dyslexia. So the two areas of the brain that are most impacted is this area in the back that's in charge of your vision. It's called the occipital lobe. And so if you look at the brain of a person with dyslexia during a language task, this area is not lit up at all. And the other area that's significantly impacted is this area over the ear that's called the parietal temporal lobe, which is, you know, how your brain is processing sound. So it's the vision and the sound parts of the brain that are just less active during language tasks. So if the two people, a typical brain and a brain with dyslexia, are side by side, their eyes are closed, the brain is going to look the same. But when you give them a language task, the person with dyslexia is not going to have activity in those areas, which means that because the way I see it and the way that I hear it are not activated, I might reverse a letter. I might add letters in when I'm trying to spell something, or I might omit those, or I might have an entire syllable that's missing. I might be reading along and having a really hard time figuring out that this word is cat. And then two lines later, I see the same word and it's like amnesia. Like I've never seen it before. I have to start all over. It's very frustrating. It's laborsome. It feels really overwhelming. So some of that developmentally is tricky because, you know, as a little person, you can still reverse your letters and numbers up until you're seven. And that can be completely typical. And so it's sometimes tricky to know, is this really what I'm dealing with, or is it dyslexia? So you're kind of looking at the weight of the evidence saying, did this child struggle to learn their alphabet? Were they late to start speaking? Do they have trouble rhyming words? Am I seeing that they're delayed in spelling? Am I seeing that they're delayed in reading? So you kind of add all of these things together to give you, you know, a more comprehensive picture. But if you want to know for sure, you would get what's called a neuropsych evaluation. So you're going into an evaluator and you're testing your intelligence against your reading and writing skills. So if there is a discrepancy between those, you can say, this is an intelligent person, but we have an unexpected delay in reading and spelling.
Right. Right, Dr. Rebecca. Now, I want to understand about the numbers. You talk about the reading crisis in the U.S., mm-hmm. Why is it only in the US? Why don't we see, is it because there people are doing much more testing for this or understanding it? A much more system is much more active? Or is it that it's the same numbers in other places, but people are not aware about it? Or maybe we don't see it in general life, but actually the incidence is as much high as in the US, or mm-hmm. is it only in the US? Help us understand these numbers from a common person's perspective.
Yeah, that's a great question. So it is still prevalent in other areas. I believe that the UK also has like 80% of the people that are on a learning disability plan are there because of reading. So I think that that happens globally. However, the language does have an impact on that. So English is not always 100% phonetic. Like we have gathered a lot of pieces of other languages throughout time. And so the French invasion definitely brought words from France into the English language. And so if the language is more phonetic, it can actually be easier for a person with dyslexia to overcome that and to learn those things in that language. But English is particularly difficult. In addition, the education system that we have for teachers does not prepare well someone to support dyslexia. So as I mentioned, like my teacher journey, I was the English teacher. So the person responsible for teaching reading and literature, it never came up once in any of my coursework. Like this is what it is. This is how you identify it. This is how you support it. Not once. And so I think that, you know, in general, the curriculum that we have, the way that we approach teacher training is just lacking significantly in support for that area.
Right, right, Dr. Rebecca. So help us understand, is it possible that a child or even slightly grown up may be not dyslexic when they are being communicated in their mother language, a mother tongue, and they might be, you know, tongue-tied when or whatever you may want to call it, it happens with English language. Does it happen?
Yeah, so I think, you know, what you're kind of talking about is sometimes focus can have an impact on our language production too. So if you're really tired, like you mentioned, and you know multiple languages, the fatigue can impact your ability to translate and be able to speak in another language fluently, or word retrieval sometimes, like, oh, I know this word and I can't quite get to it. So that can be a trait of dyslexia. However, that can also be related to how your brain is functioning, which of course can have a relationship to your gut and your gut health and, you know, some of the other things happening within the body and with focus. So just because you're having, you know, language retrieval issues, if you've got, you know, a word finding problem, or you might be struggling to use another language, yes, it could be a sign of dyslexia, but it's not the only thing. It can certainly be fatigue too.
Absolutely. In that sense, if you ask, sometimes when ChatGPT can be dyslexic, because if you ask it in another language, it finds difficult to comprehend. It takes a huge amount of time. Even in English, if you ask it a much more twisted question or in a different manner, it takes time to come up with an answer. You must have seen it. I have seen it. I'm just trying to find some sort of a humor into this, but I am still trying to understand. Tell me one more thing, Dr. Rebecca, is that in earlier days, were the number of dyslexics or the incidence of finding these numbers, that was much more than today, or was it less? What does the historical figures tell us about this?
That's a great question. So there was a famous study done a number of years ago called the Connecticut Longitudinal Study. What they did is they went into a school system and they interviewed people and they said, how many students do you have in this school that are dyslexic? And so the self-reported number was like 2%. We really don't have students like that here. And so they said, great, we're going to test every single student that you have in this building. And when they got done, they found out that, you know, 35% or something of them did have dyslexia, but it was the misunderstanding of what it was. So the self-reported number was 2%, but in fact, you know, 35 something percent of them, and it was, you know, one in five, maybe more, actually had dyslexia. We just didn't know how to properly identify it. So I think that it's likely been prevalent for a long time. It's just that we're really now starting to have a deeper understanding of what it is, how to screen for it, how to identify it, that maybe we just didn't have before.
Right. So what are the solutions for it? Is every difficulty in reading by a child is a problem, or is it a warning in itself, or is need some sort of an intervention? How does it work?
Yeah, great question. So it is possible to reorganize the brain. So the more that we learn about the brain, the more advanced our equipment gets, the more that we can see that the brain changes quite a bit. So if you have the opportunity to learn a new language, if you start to learn an instrument, if you meditate, like there are actual images that show before and after and how the brain has changed, you know, and that, I think that that's also true for people who have had epilepsy or they've had surgical removal of entire portions of the brain, and the brain's been able to kind of reroute its pathways to cause other areas to now take over that function. So through repetition and really explicit direct instruction, you can help the brain to actually use these areas in that visual and auditory portion so that reading and writing are easy. And it doesn't take years and years. Like, you can do that within a period of months, but it does require specific, explicit, repetition-based, you know, practice over an interval of time in order for that to happen.
Right. So what are the options for parents if they say suspect or they have a confirmed case that there is a issue with reading from their child's side?
Great question. So one of the things that you can do actually even on our website, so if you go to drrebeccatroy.com, there's a button up at the top that says screener. And so what can happen is, you know, if you're waiting to get an official diagnosis, that process can be sometimes 6 months to a year because there's so many people waiting to get one of those tests. They can be several thousands of dollars. They can be very, very labor intensive. And, you know, the school can also diagnose, but then you're in that wait to fail moment. So you can take these tests. There's three of them specifically that'll be in phonological awareness and reading and spelling that will kick out an immediate score for you to say, okay, my child's reading score for their age is at the fifth percentile and their spelling score is at the first percentile and their phonological awareness is maybe low. And so you start to add those things together and you say, ooh, okay, so this is a discrepancy in what their typical performance is per intelligence. And so that's how you diagnose those things, is you say, is there a discrepancy between the intelligence of this person and how they're performing in reading and spelling? So you can do that within an hour at home and click on that link and it will allow you to get that information like right now. But if you do know that you have an issue and you're saying like, yeah, we're struggling to get the school, like my child's school doesn't know anything about this, or we don't have any kind of support in our town or anything like that, it can be really empowering to know that you can yourself learn how to do these exercises at home with your child. So it's going to require about 10 to 15 minutes a day for about 4 months, but you can yourself reorganize the way that your child's brain is hearing and responding to the language. So if you're interested in doing that and you want to take that on yourself, there's a button to click there. You can, you know, we have complimentary calls where we speak with you to really learn if your child is truly a candidate. And so we would be happy to do that with you at any time to see if that's a good fit.
Okay, Dr. Rebecca. So it means that through retraining their brains, dyslexic brain, they can actually heal themselves of it, and it will be, that healing part will be permanent.
Right. So as long as the child continues reading and spelling, they will use those new areas. So one of the questions that we get a lot is like, there's a lot of giftedness that comes with a neurodivergent brain. So their ability to be creative, their ability to have lateral thinking, spatial thinking is exceptional. And so none of those things disappear. It's just getting those areas between sight and sound to be reconnected. So as long as the child maintains that they're going to continue reading and writing, they will maintain those connections. Now, if you stop reading and writing entirely, then the brain does prune those things back out, like learning a language that you never use, like, oh, I don't need this anymore, I'm going to take that away. But for most kids, especially kids that are in school, they have to read and write. And so that usually does not happen.
Right. So some kids, they take a bit of time to, you know, either walk, speak, or even, you know, come to that high level of being themselves. It just takes, you know, some people comprehend things, takes a bit of time. Some people are very quick, you know, and each one is gifted in their own manner.
Yes.
Is it that, you know, all kids who the assessment considers as dyslexic, they may not actually be normal and are taking their own time? How does our modern understanding of this differentiate between the two, or does it not differentiate at all?
Yeah, great question. So those assessments are what we would call norm referenced. So they've tested hundreds of thousands of people and they've said this is what typical performance is for that age. So you can see, is my child's performance typical for what they should be doing developmentally, or is it not? And so I think the more evidence that you have that it's not quite there, the more strong the case is that you might actually be dealing with something far greater than just a lag in development. But what I would say is that for a lot of our clients specifically, they had been told like, oh, especially if it was a boy, the boys develop more slowly, this will just come. you know, don't worry about it. It's just going to resolve itself. And the truth is that unless you do some specific, very intentional rewiring, it doesn't just resolve itself. So a lot of the families will say, I wish I hadn't listened to that because, you know, I could have started earlier. My child's developed some real negative self-esteem and self-talk. They feel really stupid because they can't do all of these things that other classmates can. I wished I would have started sooner, but I listened to this like, oh, but it'll just come advice. So I think the best case scenario is that you just start collecting information. You know, you learn a lot through observation. And as a parent, you see your kid all the time. So start observing, like, how often is this happening? Is this just once in a while? Or is it like every day we're having these struggles? And especially if I've got some data that's from a norm referenced assessment that's also saying this is abnormally low, you can start to really build that case of, okay, it really appears like we're dealing with something more significant here.
Right, right, Dr. Rebecca. Now, can it happen that this person is able to read social media messages but is not able to read books? Does it happen that way? Or even reading social media can also be the sign of non-dyslexic.
Yeah, so great question. I think that what's true is most people with dyslexia have average or above average intelligence. So sometimes because they're great at having a photographic memory or they can memorize things, a lot of the common or more frequently used words, they've just committed to memory. It's not like they're actually reading them, so to speak, but they've just memorized that that's what it is. So for those kids, when you get into a book or things that are more challenging, maybe the words aren't used as frequently, you can really start to see the wheels come off where like, ooh, I've got a word that I actually have to try to decode, but I don't have any word attack skills. My brain cannot do that. So I think there can sometimes be a discrepancy between maybe what I do on social media, which is using a lot of these more common, frequently used words, as opposed to when you're reading a text that's more challenging, less frequently used words.
Right. And what is the level of the understanding in neuroscience in terms of that these exercises will not help? So does neuroscience have some additional, you can say, something to offer for such children?
Absolutely. And I think the biggest thing is just knowing that neuroscience is a thing. Neuroplasticity is real. And so the more that we can see with the advancement of technology, I think the more powerful that that becomes. So I think we're just on the cusp of really understanding what our brains are truly capable of. And if we can learn and grow and like, oh, wow, I could actually help myself with things like anxiety or depression or any of those things, if I were to just kind of reorganize the way that my habits and repetitive patterns are in my brain, then I can actually change what that looks like. So I really do think that we're at the cusp now of really having a larger revolution of what's possible for us. But absolutely, neuroscience is a thing, and you can reorganize the way that the brain is hearing and responding to language. So, you know, I think if you have this archaic view, like you just cannot change it, it's forever, and I'm always going to struggle, that's just simply not true.
Absolutely. There is much to understand about these things, and there is much to understand from you about these things, Dr. Rebecca. So all those people who would like to, you know, connect with you, take your advice, take your training, what is the best way for them to do so?
A great question. So there's a number of different ways that you can connect with us. Probably the easiest way is to just go to the website, drrebeccatroy.com. There's access to that screener that I was telling you about that you can do right from home. There's access to, you know, book a call with our team to see if this is a great fit for you. Some of our social media accounts, we always are celebrating clients. So, you know, to see the transformation from before and after, every other week, we're celebrating a new client case study in our Facebook group, so you can join that. We've got a YouTube channel where we interview parents all the time about what it was like before and after. So you can connect with us in any of those ways, but probably the easiest way is to just start from the website, and then you can click from there to whatever interests you most.
Wonderful. With this, it's a wrap on this very special edition of the KJ Masterclass Live. Thank you so much indeed for joining us.
Thank you.